It was generally small amounts, but small amounts add up.
The city of Anchorage finds a computer mistake that has cost millions in overtime pay. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 21st of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, environmentalists take a message to Washington.
They all urge the Secretary and President Obama to protect the Arctic Ocean and Bristol Bay from oil and gas development.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. THREAD helps families make good choices about early care and education for their children. Formerly known as Child Care Connection, THREAD connects families throughout Alaska with quality child care, family child care programs, licensed centers, preschool or Head Start programs at no cost. THREAD offers parenting workshops, resources, and help with parenting issues. Find out more online at threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by THREAD, connecting early care and education to Alaska.
An overlooked computer glitch in Anchorage is being blamed for about $2 million worth of overtime paid in error to city employees. As APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports, the mistake remained undetected for a decade.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan is wrestling with a $25 million shortfall in the city's budget. Municipal officials are looking for ways to cut city spending, but for 10 years now, an error in a computer code may have cut a hole in the city's pocket. Last week, the payroll programming flaw was made public. It is estimated that the mistake cost the city about $2 million over the past decade. Nancy Usera, the Muni's employee relations director under the new Sullivan administration, says an audit found the flaw some time ago.
The error was pointed out in an audit as long ago as 2003. And I think that that audit was filed on a shelf and nothing was done about it. Now, whether that was a conscious decision or whether it was just an audit was done and nobody followed through on it, I can't speculate because it was way before my time.
Usera said she became aware of it in early August of this year. Efforts to fix the overtime snafu have included an evaluation of union collective bargaining agreements. Usera says the mistake was originally made when payroll software called PeopleSoft was installed about 10 years ago. There's been a lot of water under the bridge since then, and a quick shift in mayoral administrations since former Mayor Mark Begich left Anchorage to take a senator's job in Washington, D.C., has only compounded the problem. Sharon Weddleton was city finance director under interim mayor Matt Klayman. Weddleton says she learned about the error a couple of months before Klayman lost his bid for mayor to current Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan in July. Weddleton says she no longer works for the city and would not go on tape for this story, but she points out that there may have been a reason for the additional overtime in the first place, due to a collective bargaining agreement with city unions. Weddleton, too, brought the glitch to the attention of city officials as a way to save money, but the Klayman administration gave way to the Sullivan administration before any action could be taken. Weddleton says the PeopleSoft system the city uses has not been updated in years and would most likely be expensive to do so. But Usera says it's only a formula that needs changing.
I mean, we just have to go in and correct the programming and the formula, and it is being done, and it will be triggered on October 25th.
She says the amount of individual overtime pay was small, but spread over 10 years and thousands of employees.
Small amounts add up.
Estimates are that the overtime pay cost the city about $200,000 to $225,000 a year since the software was installed. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Environmentalists gathered today outside the Interior Department in Washington, D.C. to deliver a message: don't drill in the Arctic Ocean or Bristol Bay. The group of about two dozen people symbolically turned over a giant comment card representing more than 260,000 comments they gathered to halt a proposed development plan. Cindy Shogun, executive director of the Alaska Wilderness League, handed the comment card to the Interior Department's director of Alaska Affairs, Kim Elton.
They all urged the Secretary and President Obama to protect the Arctic Ocean and Bristol Bay from oil and gas development.
All right. Thank you.
Elton would not comment because the public process is still in play. Today is the last day to weigh in by letter or email on the proposed five-year plan for Outer Continental Shelf oil and gas development. President Bush presented it during his final days in office, 3 years ahead of schedule. The current offshore plan doesn't end until 2012. The Obama administration slowed down the process and extended the public comment period, which ends today at midnight Eastern time. The plan includes lease sales in the Beaufort and Chukchi Sea and Bristol Bay. Last week, Alaska Governor Sean Parnell met with Interior Secretary Ken Salazar to urge following the plan and opening more of the Arctic to development. Today, however, it was environmentalists' turn to present their message. They handed out free Alaska salmon patties across the street from the Interior Department and carried signs calling for protection of fisheries and the Arctic. Alaska Wilderness League spokeswoman Kristen Miller says more research should be done on the effects of development in the far north.
We would like to see a timeout on oil and gas development and a multi-agency task force pulled together to develop a comprehensive plan for the Arctic, one that looks at both protecting the fragile ecosystem and deciding when, where, and how development should happen, if at all.
The gathered environmentalists represented groups including the World Wildlife Fund and the Wilderness Society. Senator Mark Begich also turned in his comments to the Interior Department today. He encouraged development in the Arctic, but also said it should be balanced with local needs and based on sound science. Begich says he is particularly concerned about oil and gas development in Bristol Bay because of the importance of its fisheries. The Obama administration's Ocean Policy Task Force has just released its ocean management plan that, among other things, sets up a National Ocean Council. The council will be chaired by members of the Council on Environmental Quality and the Office of Science and Technology Policy. Numerous federal agencies, including Interior, Commerce, and Homeland Security, will be part of the new council. Dr. Nancy Sutley is the chair of the President's Council on Environmental Quality. She says the idea is to bring federal agencies that have a role in managing ocean resources to be part of the National Council.
And we envision that that would mean that we'll have high-level engagement from these agencies in order to more effectively manage how the federal government interacts with the oceans.
Is this a different approach to have agencies come together on a council such as this?
Well, it is in the sense that it's under the framework of a national ocean policy. We have had a number of ways the federal government has tried to organize itself over the oceans, but without any real overarching policy framework that we would base decision-making on. So the governance, I guess this is we hope a case where form follows function, where we tried to set up an appropriate way for the federal government to organize itself to carry out the aims of the national ocean policy.
Dr. Sutley, where do you think some of the first efforts need to be concentrated? Where's the most critical need for improvements in our ocean management?
One of the areas that we highlighted was the Arctic, which is certainly important in Alaska, but a place of both emerging knowledge and, you know, emerging levels of activity that haven't been seen in the recent past. Also looking at things like observing systems and monitoring, and what do we know about the oceans and how they're changing, and how different activities in the ocean interact with each other. And also, we have also been charged to develop a framework for what's called marine spatial planning as a way of understanding how different activities happen in the oceans and how we could avoid conflicts.
The report's task force called for using best available science and taking a precautionary approach. What will this mean when it's applied to offshore development, and how is that different from past administrations' ocean policy efforts?
I think in terms of things like offshore development, we want to, currently, you know, statutory frameworks for assessing whether offshore development is appropriate on any number of different activities. So we're not proposing right now to replace any of those frameworks, but to better inform the decision making that's made under those frameworks.
And what type of impact could this new or different direction have on offshore development such as oil and gas, and also offshore wind energy projects?
Well, offshore oil and gas development right now is, you know, there's existing federal legislation. The Secretary of Interior, I think the comment period ended today on the taking additional comment on the five-year plan. I know he held a hearing in Anchorage and received a lot of comment. The Department of Interior has been a part of the Ocean Policy Task Force. And again, I think the idea is to better inform the decision-making that's made under statutes like the Offshore Outer Continental Shelf Leasing Act and things like renewable energy development. How we look at all of the activities that may happen in a certain space in the ocean.
Ocean impacts aren't just coming from the United States. How much weight will the National Ocean Council have as far as impacting the way other nations do business in the oceans?
The United States, although we carry on our activities consistent with international law, we are not yet a party to the UN Law of the Sea Treaty, and the task force highlights that as an area which would be important for the U.S. to accede to the Law of the Sea Treaty.
Dr. Nancy Sutley is the chair of the President's Council on Environmental Quality. The next deadline for the Ocean Policy Task Force is December, when they will release a framework for marine spatial planning. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, measuring the price of health care for Alaskans.
Health care in Alaska ranges anywhere from 50% to 100% greater than the cost of health care in the lower 48.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others, claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Province has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30th, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus Oregon Province.
Healthcare legislation continues to dominate the work in Congress this week. Tomorrow, the Senate Finance Committee starts marking up a bill proposed by Democratic Senator Max Baucus of Montana. So far, it does not have the support of committee Republicans, and many Democrats' reaction is lukewarm. Both of Alaska senators say they'll carefully watch this week's markup to see how the bill shapes up. Democrat Senator Mark Begich says there are elements he likes, including an emphasis on preventative care, forcing insurance companies to cover pre-existing conditions, and limiting out-of-pocket expenses for consumers. It also expands Medicaid to cover people earning up to 133% of the poverty level. But Begich says he does see some problems.
I have concerns on how it approaches Medicare reimbursement over the long haul. It's a two-year provision, which is better than 1 year, better than none, which is good in a sense of its rate adjustments. But how that goes long-term is, to me, going to be important.
Begich says he also has concerns about mandating coverage and whether employees will be penalized. He says he does applaud the deficit reductions Baucus has put forth.
He kept his deficit neutral, actually a deficit reduction of about $30-40 billion, I think it was, which is a good sign. But I want to make sure that the economics are not being paid by, you know, these small business owners and these individuals that are just trying to get some coverage so they can cover minimum catastrophic and beyond.
Begich signed on to a letter with other moderate Democrats asking Baucus to find more cost-cutting measures. The proposal carries a price tag of about $850 billion. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's worried about how the plan will be paid for.
There's also included in the Baucus proposal this proposal that you find other cuts by taking about $17 billion from the amount of money that individuals can put in their flexible spending accounts. I don't think that this is good policy to be discouraging people to save for their health care services.
Murkowski says she wants to make sure cost savings don't come at consumers' expense.
We really haven't addressed what we need to be doing. If we say, okay, you are required under this mandate to have health care insurance, but yet we haven't truly reduced those costs that you will be forced to take on, we haven't really put you much further ahead than when we started here.
Meanwhile, health care insurance premiums in Alaska have increased by more than 90%, according to a new report from a national health care organization. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
Families USA and the Alaska Center for Public Policy have jointly released a report that documents changes in the cost of health care coverage in Alaska compared to changes in average earnings by Alaska workers. The report is called Costly Coverage: Premiums Outpace Paychecks in Alaska. Lawrence Wise is the executive director of the Alaska Center for Public Policy, which touts itself as a progressive Alaska-based think tank.
The cost of health care, depending on how you measure it, the very latest cost estimates are that health care in Alaska ranges anywhere from 50% to 100% greater than the cost of health care in the lower 48. Part of the reason is over 60% of all the insurance, the private commercial insurance sold here in Alaska is sold by one company. And between them and a second company, I believe something like 95% of the market is controlled by two companies. So the notion of competition for health insurance is really out the window. Monopoly describes it much better than competition from the health insurance point of view.
The new report shows that for individual health coverage, the worker portion of the annual premiums rose from around $370 to over $860 between 2000 and 2009, which is an increase of over 133%. The employer's contribution during that same time frame increased by about 86%. Weiss says the cost of health care insurance is taking a bigger and bigger bite out of the income of many Alaska families.
If you keep the cost of health insurance stable year to year, what's happening is you're having these much higher deductibles. You know, back in the old days, it was maybe a $1,500 deductible before your insurance dollar kicked in for the first insurance dollar for the family. Now, $5,000 is not uncommon. $10,000 is not uncommon. Well, families that can't afford high premiums certainly cannot afford those kinds of deductibles. So that's sort of like fake insurance. And of course, at the same time, many businesses, the small and medium-sized businesses, are dropping health insurance altogether.
The new report comes as the Congress, the Obama administration, and state governments are struggling to figure out the best way to put in place health care reform. Weiss hopes the state of Alaska will not wait on a federal reform plan.
You know, the fact is people need health care now. I mean, there's around 130,000 Alaskans that don't have health insurance and presumably don't have access. And there's a lot more that have health insurance that's pretty much unusable and don't really have real access to health care. So we really need to do whatever we can at the state level to give people real access to health care, regardless of what happens at the federal level, because we don't know what will kick in and we don't know when. And anything we enact at the state level can be undone. It can be changed, in any way necessary to conform with the new federal situation.
You can find the new report on healthcare premiums in Alaska online at familiesusa.org. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The state's top lawyer says Alaska has every right to tax cruise ship passengers. The industry filed a lawsuit last week challenging $46 of the $50 head tax. Attorney General Dan Sullivan says the Department of Law will fight the suit.
There's no doubt that the passengers that come on the cruise ships contribute significantly to our economy. But it's also undisputed that the state and local communities have provided significant infrastructure and services to host these passengers, and the law allows for users of such services to be required to pay their fair share of the costs.
The state collects about $50 million a year from the tax. $4 per person funds an environmental monitoring program, which the suit does not challenge. The rest goes to tourism-related projects and services. The industry says some of those projects do not support cruise ships, which breaks the law. Tax authors criticize some of the spending, but say the tax is legal and should survive a court challenge. An environmental group and the state of Alaska would give several cruise ship companies below average grades on pollution compliance. Friends of the Earth has released a cruise ship report card for companies operating in the United States. It shows the highest grade, a B, goes to Holland America Line, and the lowest, an F, to Royal Caribbean. The organization grades the cruise lines on three categories. Sewage treatment and air pollution reduction applies to ships operating in all U.S. waters. The third category, water quality compliance, is Alaska-specific, the degree to which ships violated 2008 water pollution standards in Alaska. The state of Alaska also monitors compliance with state and federal discharge laws for wastewater and air pollution.
I'm certainly not prepared to give a grade in response to Friends of the Earth's grade, but I can say that Princess would get the lowest wastewater grade.
That's Denise Koch, the program manager for the state's cruise ship program in the Department of Environmental Conservation. Last year, the state issued 20 wastewater treatment violations to 12 individual ships. According to Koch, 15 violations went to Princess ships. Silver Sea, Regent, and Norwegian Cruise Lines each had one wastewater violation in 2008.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world.
An Alaska-based soldier from Louisiana has died of injuries sustained in a helicopter crash in Iraq. 20-year-old specialist Michael S. Cote worked on UH-60 Black Hawk helicopters, and he was in one that went down Saturday in Balad. Army officials say Cote of Denham Springs, Louisiana, was based at Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks. Cote joined the Army and moved to Alaska in March 2008. He was assigned to A Company, 1st Battalion, 52nd Aviation Regiment, Task Force 49. Canada is officially on board with a plan for a power line in northwest British Columbia. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced last week from Washington, D.C., that the federal government will invest in a transmission line project that will run along Highway 37 in northern B.C. The announcement is not only a big win for Canadian development proponents, but also for the city and borough of Wrangell and other supporters who have long pushed for an electrical intertie from Alaska to British Columbia. KSTK's Tony Gorman has the story.
The announcement means that the federal government of Canada will set aside funding up to $130 million for the Northwest Transmission Line. News of Prime Minister Harper's announcement sent shockwaves to the major players of the project. Elmer Derrick is the co-chair of the Highway 37 Coalition in British Columbia, which has taken the lead in pushing for the transmission line. He says his organization was excited about the news.
The provincial government was committed to this project quite a while ago, and they committed $250 million towards the construction, and now we have another $130 million committed by Canada. So with those two investments, we should be able to talk about a project as opposed to just a proposal.
The project will be funded under Canada's Green Infrastructure Fund, which is federal stimulus money that goes toward energy projects. Bing Giroux is the general secretary of the Highway 37 Coalition. He says the coalition's strong advocates were key in convincing the Canadian government. He says one of those advocates is the city and borough of Wrangell.
As you can see, the prime minister announced it in Washington, D.C., following his meetings with President Obama. This goes to speaks to the idea that this is part of a larger, North American energy strategy, and what connecting the people of Alaska to the North American grid actually means, and why it's important to both leaders.
Wrangell is the only American entity in the 34-member Highway 37 coalition. The borough joined earlier this year as part of their effort to create an AKBC intertie. Wrangell Mayor Don McConaghy says the funding is a good start, but he says obviously they're going to need more money to complete the project.
Hopefully
hopefully that will be forthcoming in later announcements from different sections of government, and probably from the private sector. I'm sure that they're going to invest in that line too. But it could be a very good thing also for Southeast Alaska and Wrangell in particular.
Wrangell's goals of creating the intertie involves connecting a transmission line along the nearby Bradfield corridor to the Northwest Transmission Line. The intertie is expected to allow the sale of power from new and existing hydro plants from Southeast Alaska to BC and the North American power grid. Word of the announcement made it to this week's Southeast Conference in Haines. Jim Strandberg is project manager for the Alaska Energy Authority. He says the announcement is huge for Southeast Alaska.
When we can move more towards an interconnected network between British Columbia and Alaska by building infrastructure, that is a good move and a positive move. We've got, obviously, a long ways to go before any interconnection could occur, but this is one positive step.
Wrangell Assemblymember Warren Edgley has played a key role in Wrangell's involvement on the issue. He says the creation of the intertie is crucial in getting other energy projects going in Southeast Alaska.
It has to happen or those projects won't be developed. But it's not just the projects in Thomas Bay. It provides an outlet for if they built Thayer Lake and Angoon up to the capacity that it can be built to. It gives an outlet for Tkatz Power.
Edgley says the next step in the AKBC intertie effort is to develop a strategy to get the plan in front of Congress. The reaction of the announcement was mostly positive, but for some, providing power to Southeast Alaska first before selling it to others remains a top priority. While testifying at an energy hearing at the Southeast Conference, Petersburg Mayor Al Dwyer says he believes Alaska needs to take care of its own before selling power to someone else.
We want to break even. We want to have a reserve fund to fix things when they break. And we want the lowest possible energy cost to the people of Southeast Alaska. Once that's done, sell it to anybody for any price.
The announcement may be huge, but there are some kinks that still need to be worked out. The money from the Canadian federal government will only help build part of the transmission line. The Highway 37 Coalition will be looking to other resources in the coming months for funding to match at least $93 million Canadian dollars to finish the project. Building a power line along the Bradfield corridor won't be enough to connect an AKBC intertie. If the line is built to the U.S.-Canadian border, it is another 60 miles to the future Northwest Transmission Line, and that could take even more funding. With help from Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfield, I'm Tony Gorman reporting from Wrangell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Tony Gorman in Wrangell. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others, claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Province has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus Oregon Province.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.